This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, we continue our coverage of the struggle for a free Palestine.
Rooted in a history of resistance to ethnic cleansing and genocide, the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network stands with Palestinians against Israeli occupation and ethnic cleansing.
Jewish protesters speak up against Zionist attacks on Palestine.
No imperialist power can carry out a war for any sustained period of time without either the active or passive support of their workers. Any solution has to start with international solidarity, that we're not going to kill each other for the profits of our bosses.
Trade unionists are challenging the support for the state of Israel within the labor movement.
We're really seeing a McCarthyite repression where people are being blacklisted, fired, doxxed, and criminally targeted for taking principled stance for Palestinian freedom.
Students across the U.S. are facing relentless smears and doxing attacks for their activism in support of Palestinian rights.
If anyone thinks this is a situation under control for which you can plan and implement, they are making false and irresponsible assumptions.
Palestinian and Israeli ambassadors address the UN Security Council after the U.S. ambassador vetoes a humanitarian pause to the fighting in Gaza. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. People all over the world have taken to the streets in thousands to protest U.S.-sponsored Israeli attacks on Gaza. Washington, D.C. is no exception. Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke reports.
A crowd of some 10,000 American Jews and allies, sponsored by Jewish Voice for Peace, rallied against the Israeli bombing of Gaza at the Capitol Reflecting Pool on Wednesday, October 18, in Washington. It then marched up Capitol Hill to stage a protest and sit-in at the House Cannon Office Building. Organizers claimed this was the largest Jewish protest in solidarity with Palestinians ever. As rabbis blew traditional shofars inside the Cannon Building rotunda, thousands outside sang folk songs and chanted "Ceasefire now, let Gaza live, and stop the genocide." Independence Avenue was shut down for 3 hours while elected officials and staffers watched from their windows and Capitol Police formed lines at key entrances. Dozens of additional cops were quickly sent to reinforce those arresting some 300 of the many sitting down inside the rotunda. According to the Washington Post, three of those arrested were charged with assault on a police officer. Here are a few voices and sounds of march participants.
I'm here because we need to stop this genocide right now. Yesterday, a hospital was bombed and many people died, hundreds of people. I'm here because the U.S. funds this. They're sending billions of dollars right now to kill Palestinians instead of to help Americans live, instead of helping people with housing, education, or health care. They're sending money to kill Palestinians.
The U.S. government has been doing that for 70 years.
They've
been subsidizing the Zionist state. They see it strategically as some sort of forward base, I guess. I don't know. What do you feel is the ultimate solution for the Palestinian people achieving some semblance of justice and freedom?
Well, I believe that land must be given back, that Palestinians should have the right to return, should have the right to live peacefully on their lands and have sovereignty over their land. So instead of the current situation right now, which is that they live under occupation, even in the West Bank, even in Gaza before now, they have been living under Israeli occupation with soldiers on their land, with settlers coming to their land and killing people or hurting people without any consequences. It's very similar to Native American reservations here in the U.S., how people go and kill and kidnap Native American women. The same thing happens in Palestine. So the ultimate solution is to end the occupation.
Is there a future for Hebrew workers in a free Palestine?
Absolutely. I think that everybody has the right to refuge. Anybody should be able to seek safety and to live somewhere where they are not under attack. Palestinians are Christian, Jewish, and Muslim. They are not just Muslim. So Palestinians have been living in peace with one another for centuries before the occupation, and they can continue to do so after the occupation is lifted.
What has happened to the Palestinian Jews?
Palestinian Jews, well, some of them have been integrated into the state of Israel, but others have been expelled from the state because they refused to do so.
Yeah.
I'm really horrified. I mean, I can't even describe how I feel about what's going on with the attacks on Gaza right now. I mean, first, of course, I was horrified by the attacks on the people in Israel.
Yes.
But they were provoked because the new Israeli government is even worse than the usual Israeli government. And they were going after the mosque, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They were going, pushing people. The settlers were pushing people out. They were just putting tons of pressure on the Palestinian people and looking like they were looking for a cause to go in. So I don't know how the people who did the massacre actually got in at all. And I have to be a little bit suspicious because the Israeli government really has that area very, very secure. So I don't know what to think, but it was totally horrific. I mean, it's disgusting. And, you know, I call Congress nonstop, but I don't get any response. You know, just, oh, it's complicated. We're working on a two-state solution. You know, a bunch of garbage. I mean, you have these poor people, mostly children, being bombed and no food, no water. I heard of my Congresswoman, Kirsten Gillibrand, my senator, rather, Kirsten Gillibrand. She spoke the other day on Brian Lehrer's show, and she said, oh, we're trying to get aid in, but Hamas is stopping us at the border. And I mean, then that's bull. I mean, you know, how can she just get away with saying that? You know, it's awful.
The lyrics of the folk song Lo Yisa Goy, heard here translate as, a nation shall not raise a sword against a nation, and they shall not learn any more war. For Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, this is Thomas O'Rourke.
Students across the U.S. are facing relentless smears and doxing attacks for their activism in support of Palestinian rights as Israel continues its genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip. Palestine Legal, a civil rights group, is asking students and activists to contact them immediately to seek legal help and report incidents of harassment, threats, and assaults. Radhika Saina, senior staff attorney with Palestine Legal, spoke to Nora Barrows-Friedman of the Electronic Intifada podcast.
So just to give you a little bit of an overview of what we're seeing at Palestine Legal, we're seeing Students for Justice in Palestine and Palestinian students threatened with violence and anti-Palestinian and Islamophobic messages who are unable to get support from their schools and basically being treated differently because they're Palestinian. So for example, today, you know, students at UMass Amherst reported to us how they were being told by fellow students that they're quote unquote Islamic barbarism supporters who quote love raping and killing. And even a student told them in person at a protest that all Arabs should be killed. And the school has refused to put out statements supporting the students as it has with other student groups of different national origins when they've been the recipients of such hate. We've seen students being smeared as supporting terrorists, removed from positions, or being investigated by their schools for making statements that are pretty much the same as the one that the Haaretz editorial board made. We're seeing professors at universities being questioned, their classes canceled, being locked out of their email all of a sudden, over statements made supporting Palestinian rights. And some of these statements are public statements on social media, but others have been just private communications over personal email. Again, taking a principled stance against genocide and ethnic cleansing. We've seen massive doxing efforts, naming students who have signed statements in solidarity with Palestinians, calling these lists, quote unquote, college terror lists. And these students have faced severe harassment, death threats, and threats to target their careers. It's McCarthyite, to say the least. We've also seen universities and K through 12 administrators make statements only supporting Israeli students and not, you know, basically ignoring Palestinian students who have experienced loss. This is particularly troubling, of course, given the skyrocketing number of Palestinian deaths in Gaza right now. We've also seen blanket statements supporting Israel or condemning, quote unquote, you know, Hamas terror by school administrators, which of course fuels this Islamophobic and anti-Palestinian environment, which led to the death of a 6-year-old child in Illinois, which I'm sure people saw reports of in the news. And again, you know, we're also seeing universities monitoring Palestinian students and groups supporting Palestinian rights, investigating them under the flimsiest of excuses. Students are also have been contacting us. They're really worried that they're going to be kicked out of school for just signing, you know, statements, again, that are protected by the First Amendment, expressing solidarity for Palestinians. So the list goes on and on. But the bottom line is that we're really seeing a McCarthyite repression where people are being blacklisted, fired, doxxed, and, you know, criminally targeted, again, for taking principled stance for Palestinian freedom.
So, yeah, what are the material ways that that students should be fighting back at this point, protecting themselves? You know, I mean, when I get these emails or these texts from students all over the country, my first response is call Palestine Legal and, you know, reach out to ADC, reach out to the Center for Constitutional Rights. After they've done that, what would be the next steps for them?
Sure. So I would say absolutely call us. And actually, the best way to contact us is through our web form on our website. We are checking that multiple times throughout the day. And trust me, if you sent us a message through that web form, we have seen it. We are triaging, though. So if you don't hear from us immediately, go to our website or Instagram, and we have just posted resources. And those are the resources, the best resources we have on hand for the issues that are most coming to us. So those include, like, what do you do if you're doxxed? What if the police or FBI visit me? What should I do? Short answer, don't talk to the police. Mm-hmm. So go there, look at those resources, and we will get back to you. As far as other steps that you can take, I want to say that one of the most important things right now, if you feel that you're, you know, if you're getting harassed, this is on campus, if you're getting harassed, if you're getting death threats, if there's any issue that you're facing of harassment or anti-Palestinian discrimination, report it to your school. I know a lot of students think, you know, oh, my school's not going to do anything. They're not going to take it seriously. Like, they know what's going on. All of that might be true, but it's really important that the school has a record of it. So, you know, just go to your school's like Title IX, just Google Title IX, your school, or DEI, your school, or even if there's a dean of students or, you know, administrator that you know, tell them what's happened in a written communication so that they are on notice about what's happening. And I think they really do need to hear over and over and over and over again what is happening to you. And it's their duty to respond. This is really important, not just because we do hope that they respond, but also because if they don't, that later, if we need to, you know, file a lawsuit or file a Title VI complaint, we can tell the university, you are on notice. Palestinian students or students, you know, speaking up for Palestinian rights or who are perceived to be Palestinian, told you multiple times that they were getting these death threats, that they were getting these harassing messages, and you did nothing and you ignored them. So please do just let your school know over and over and over again. You cannot do this too much. It's really important. And I just want to say, thirdly, there are administrators out there who are trying to do the right thing and are being told by their supervisors and by that their higher ups, no, you cannot do this. And by that, I mean, no, you cannot, you know, say the word Palestine or Palestinian in your email to support students. And so by being able to share those stories, you're helping your administrators who want to do the right thing be able to do the right thing as well.
Can you talk about what to do if the university is trying to force you to talk to the police, or if you're being harassed, intimidated by campus administrators or campus police forces. Do you have to talk to the cops?
You do not have to talk to the police. You never have to talk to the cops. You have the right to remain silent. If you're confused for any reason, you know, you can just politely ask. If you're confused about whether you are free to go, you can say, am I free to go? If the police ask you questions, you can just say, I don't want to talk. And sometimes they will actually be very friendly in order to trick you. So it's not always like in the cop shows. They might just be like, I want to have a friendly chat. Can I come in? And you can just politely say, no, I'll have my attorney call you. And if it's the FBI, you can just ask them for their card. And, you know, just repeat it over and over again. I don't want to talk. Please leave me your card. I'll have my attorney call you. It's critically important because sometimes people feel like they will look bad if they don't talk to the police. They are trained to trick you. They can lie to you, but it can be a crime to lie to a police officer or a federal agent. So it's just better that you don't do that. Mm-hmm. And I would just also add, tell your roommates. If you have a roommate, sometimes a roommate will let the police in. Right. And then all of a sudden, I remember this case from many years ago, someone was studying like Lebanese history, and there was something like a book open on Hezbollah. And, you know, that was enough, you know. So if you have a concern about letting the police in, you can always just ask, like, do you have a search warrant? If they do have a search warrant, you know, look at it and you can say, is that your address? Is it correct? Is it your apartment number? Should list the places to be searched. If it says like your roommate's room, that means they can search that room, but they can't search yours. There are more tips on our website, but you can, you know, take a look at those. But the short of it is that you never have to talk to the police.
And finally, I don't even know like how to describe how unbelievably pro-genocide some of these university administrations are revealing themselves to be, basically painting all Palestinians, including the Palestinian students on campus, of course, as bloodthirsty terrorists, subhuman, and Palestinian students can't have a protest against the genocide of their people. What do you hope comes out of this, at least when we look at the legal context on what's happening?
It's appalling, the statements, some of the statements that university administrators are making. And I will say to students, if you're at a public university, you know, you can FOIA these questions or these statements. So, and that means you can file Public Records Act requests, you can Google it. And this is supposed to be a way for regular people to do, right? So you can just Google like Public Records Act request my state, and you can get form letters, and you can just find out like what is happening behind the scenes. What is the donor pressure that's going on that is causing universities to condemn a group of people that's been living under military occupation, that is currently being ethnically cleansed from Gaza as we speak, instead of being on the side of justice. And beyond that, you know, even if you don't want to do that, you do have a duty to support your Palestinian students, to, you know, to provide them resources. You cannot ethically, as a university administrator, just say that you are providing mental health services to one subset of people and exclude another subset of people just because you don't like them. The law does not allow for that here. And that's what we're seeing that's going on. And that's one thing I think students can do right now to find out what their university is saying or doing behind the scenes that violates Palestinian students' rights.
That was Radhika Sainath, Senior Staff Attorney at Palestine Legal. To learn more or to file a report, visit palestinelegal.org. We thank the Electronic Intifada Podcast for their work.
Que nos da Israel.
That was Cumbia Palestina by Orquesta Popular San Bomba. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Not only Democratic and Republican legislators, but also the leadership of the AFL-CIO and most national unions support Zionism. However, last week, hundreds of trade unionists met online to discuss a working-class response to the collective punishment of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. Larry Goldbetter, president of the National Writers Union, is challenging support for the State of Israel within the labor movement. He spoke with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
The National Writers Union is a union of 1,300 freelance journalists and media workers, book authors, poets, writers of all kinds. And we've been in business for quite a while, and we're an affiliate of the International Federation of Journalists. Internationalism has always been a big component of our outlook. And we are fraternal unions with the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate. And we have proudly taken a lead in standing up to Israeli aggression, including the murder of Shireen Abu Akla. And unfortunately, not a lot of unions have been present in the past at those types of events in the U.S. I think that has a possibility of changing now.
And the AFL-CIO, along with the U.S. government, were for the formation of the State of Israel. They supported that, and they call themselves Zionists, the leadership of the AFL-CIO. What does that mean, that the AFL-CIO and other union leadership call themselves Zionists?
Well, I mean, I think the leadership of the AFL-CIO for quite some time has been an agent of the U.S. State Department and has always supported U.S. foreign policy, even as recent, you know, through the Vietnam War and through all of the wars in the Middle East. It's funny you should mention that. I was at a meeting last week of the New York City Jewish Labor Committee, and it was...
What is the New York Jewish Labor Committee?
I'm not exactly sure. But I got an invitation, so I went, and it was chaired by Stuart Applebaum, the president of RWDSU, and Randy Weingarten of the AFT. And basically, they were trying to get Jewish progressive labor leaders on board for this onslaught in Gaza, and praising Biden, praising, you know, we have to unite. There's nothing more we can do. This is so outrageous. We have to have full support. And the one thing it kind of made clear to me is that, in case people had questions, is that war is union business, that no imperialist power can carry out a war for any sustained period of time without either the active or passive support of their workers. And that's what the Jewish Labor Committee was trying to organize, which really lit a fire under me to do the opposite, to try and organize opposition to this war among labor leaders.
And the AFL-CIO, of course, is supporting Israel, but also it is has set up this thing, the Solidarity Center, which takes $75 million a year from the National Endowment for Democracy, a U.S. government agency for international operations in 62 countries. What is this Solidarity Center? You would think that, for example, Shireen Abu Akla would be getting support. She was an American Palestinian journalist who was killed, assassinated. Where did the AFL-CIO stand in that? Even the CWA, which is...
As far as I know, they were silent. And the U.S. government has been silent. The AFL-CIO has been silent. The UN has been silent. And of course, the Israelis have been silent. Nobody has investigated her murder.
And this is not new. Journalists, why don't you talk about the attack on journalists in Palestine, in Israel, and how they've been targeted? This is a war crime targeting journalists, but apparently when it comes to Israel, they have an exception to prosecution.
Yeah, Israel has a long history of targeting Palestinian media workers and media outlets. And in this current upsurge, I think 10 journalists have been killed so far. Two are missing that we know of. And more than 50 media offices have been destroyed. And those are all very targeted events. And there was, of course, the journalists that were killed and wounded in Lebanon in a car that was clearly targeted by the Israelis. and clearly identified as a press vehicle, everybody in it wearing press vests. So this is an ongoing tactic of theirs.
Well, also the United States bombed in Iraq a building of journalists.
Oh, yeah.
So I would say Israel is not the exception, but the United States itself
for
is
often
in a title of journalist. And you say that this is time may be different. I know that the San Francisco Labor Council, Liz Schuller and her supporters sent a letter to the Labor Council saying you can't even discuss the boycott of Israel. That's off the table. And that was used by the officials, the leadership of the Labor Council, to shut down even a discussion and debate in the labor movement. It sounds like even having a discussion and debate in the labor movement is a real battle because of the kind of bureaucratic top-down structure of these unions.
Yeah, we were formerly an affiliate of the UAW. We were a UAW local. And a number of few years ago, during one of these uprisings, two locals, especially the University of California local, passed BDS resolutions. And the International Union actually met, the International Executive Board met and reversed the votes of the locals who had voted to support BDS. And this time, you know, you can just get away with that for so long. This time, I think there's going to be more vocal opposition. And, you know, I think that's a good thing.
Well, one of the things the UAW leadership said at that time is they had members producing weapons and equipment for Israel, and that would affect their members. But at the same time, with South Africa, you know, there were Arab American auto workers who marched in Detroit saying that they should sell the bonds, and they benefit. I mean, the U.S. military budget, close to $1 trillion a year, the 800 bases around the world, it seems that's part of the United States and a major part of the United States, the military industrial complex.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the whole issue of jobs, I mean, it's such a hollow argument, such a nationalist hollow argument. You know, if Caterpillar was built, you know, had contracts with Israel to knock down Palestinian homes. And so the UAW didn't want people criticizing Caterpillar. I mean, it's just part of their pro-boss, at least the old leadership's pro-boss, pro-America outlook.
Well, the Biden administration and the leadership of the AFL-CIO say they're for a two-state solution, that they want a partner that they can get in that would support a two-state solution. You don't think that that's feasible?
I don't think it's true. They've had every opportunity for decades now to try and make that happen, and they've done everything to undermine it. I mean, personally, I have my feelings. I think South Africa could have been a great model, but where they dismantled apartheid, not with two states, but with one. And I think the unity of Jewish and Palestinian workers is kind of like the bedrock of anything moving forward. Without that, I don't see it happening. And right now, that seems a long way off.
Well, you began by saying that the workers have the power to end war. How would workers end this war? I mean, it's not just the war in Israel. There's a war in Ukraine. Billions of dollars are going to that. Billions are going to Asia. We are militarizing Japan, South Korea. It seems like we're going towards world war.
Yeah, I think we're going towards world war. And, you know, this is my personal opinions, not my union's opinions. But I think in the past, we've seen world wars turn into their opposite, turn into revolutionary upsurges. And it happened after World War One. It happened after World War Two. And I think in the long term, that's our hope for this coming war. I don't think there's any avoiding it because they're on the fast track. And this is a very dark night, a very complicated time for workers around the world. And we're going to suffer more before this is done. But the only any solution has to start with international solidarity, that we're not going to kill each other for the profits of our bosses, that workers have to unite and ultimately turn their guns around.
That was Larry Goldbetter, president of the National Writers Union, speaking with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. Brandon Mancia is the director of United Auto Workers 9A, a union that represents UAW members in the Northeast. He spoke about the class struggle and internationalism at a meeting of trade unionists last week.
You know, I think recently with the UAW strike at the Big Three, we've also, you know, aside from trying to rebuild a fighting movement, I've really started thinking about our history and where we're going to go forward from here. During World War II, in the anti-fascist fight, I think we really thought of ourselves as the arsenal of democracy, right? That famous phrase from FDR that Walter Ruffer took up. And our president, you know, Sean Fain, has said that we are the new arsenal of democracy, meaning that we are fighting a class war, right, for liberation. Workers are our liberators, and our strike is that vehicle for liberation. And if it's happening in the United States through a rebuilding, fighting labor movement, then logically that should extend to the rest of the world and workers across the globe. And in this situation, as we're seeing labor, you know, feeling the need to speak on this and find a way to intervene, it's really important for us to consider the fact that as of right now, at least in my region of the UAW, Region 9A, you know, we're encouraging the locals to have the discussion of what that would mean to extend solidarity across the globe, especially with our Palestinian workers and oppressed people in this conflict at the moment. I'll tell you right now, in that process, we're seeing in employers that we represent here, including NYU and Harvard, amongst many of the other higher education institutions where we represent workers. When workers have begun, or when the locals have begun to speak out and even simply just put out a statement calling for peace or a ceasefire, they're getting met with harassment, with doxing, right? Revealing their names and their contact info publicly against their will, against their consent, and other forms of abuse. And that's simply for speaking out, right? As a labor movement, I don't think we can stand just passively by and let this moment go without, number one, defending our members' right to free speech, defending our members doing their work to build solidarity with workers across the country and the world, and also for speaking on something that we inherently have a role in, which is as U.S. taxpayers paying into the military-industrial complex that has material interests, of which many of these administrators who are doing this doxing of our members are benefiting materially from. So I think that's the analysis that we're engaging in. That's the work that needs to be done. And I think this is a profound moment, I think, for political education and consciousness raising within our movement. And I think if we begin now to do that work through this conversation and bringing this back to our unions, I think at the very least we can do right now is begin those conversations and advance the point that we need peace in order to build the kind of world that we want to see where workers are free.
That was Brandon Mancia, UAW 9A Regional Director.
على عهدي على ديني على أرضي تلاقيني أنا لأهلي أنا فديهم أنا دمي فلسطيني 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 أنا دمي فلسطيني
على عهدي على ديني على أرضي تلاقيني أنا لأهلي أنا فديهم
والله
أنا دمي فلسطيني فلسطيني فلسطيني
أنا دمي فلسطيني يلا زافي حلوة
That was Mohammed Asaf and Dami Falestini, My Blood is Palestinian. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Thousands of people rallied on Thursday, October 19, outside the Federal Building in San Francisco, demanding a ceasefire in Gaza and Palestinians' right to return to their land. One speaker was Margo of the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network.
Thank you so much, and it's so amazing to see all of you out here. representing the International Anti-Zionist Jewish Network. We join you today in our utter grief and rage. I am the daughter and granddaughter of Holocaust survivors, and I also happen to have been born on the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. I share this with you because our ancestors resisted their oppressors. We all have the right to resist. Rooted in a history of resistance to ethnic cleansing and genocide, the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network stands with Palestinians against Israeli occupation and ethnic cleansing. And demand for Gazans to move south while bombing them is a continuation of Israel's long and ongoing violent colonization and ethnic cleansing of Palestine. It is not self-defense. Israel is a fascist, violent, supremacist state against indigenous Palestinians with genocide as its intent. Palestinians have resisted one of the most well-funded, powerful, and advanced militaries in the world, fighting occupation, colonization, and ethnic cleansing. The Palestinian struggle fortifies us and reminds us that despite Israel's massive weapons, surveillance, and constant stream of United States funding that we pay for, is existence, and it lives and breathes among all of us who stand for justice. Resistance to the outright calls for ethnic cleansing by Netanyahu and his right-wing government is an act of self-defense against the colonial and apartheid state of Israel, which has and continues to commit genocide. Our heartbreak in the face of Israeli brutality against Gaza and all of Palestine will only fuel our resolve to keep organizing. We stand with Palestine and will not stop taking action until it is free!
Robert Roth of the Haiti Action Committee also spoke.
The Haiti Action Committee stands in solidarity with the people of Palestine today, tomorrow, and forever. And we send you messages of love and support from the grassroots movement in Haiti, who have always held Palestine dear to their hearts. It's the right of the colonized to fight back against settler colonialism. It's the right of Palestinians to defend their lives and communities, which have been under constant and devastating attack by Israel. We cannot expect the 2 million people of Gaza to accept the brutal daily humiliations that the Israeli military and its settler armies have imposed. And now, as hospitals and schools are attacked and destroyed, as children are being killed by the thousands, and Israel readies for a massive ground invasion, we must take our solidarity to a new level. Who is behind all of this? Whose aid allows Israel to terrorize the Palestinian people? Which government backs Israel to the hilt with billions of dollars of aid per year? Who sends the bombs that drop on Gaza? The U.S. government, the Biden administration. What a nauseating photo of Biden hugging Netanyahu. But what a revealing photo. Let's be clear. This is a U.S. Israeli genocide against the people of Gaza. And we will never forget it. The same thing is true in Haiti, where the Biden administration and the UN occupiers have doubled down their support for the dictatorship that is oppressing the people of Haiti. That's unleashed the same kind of terror in Haiti that is being experienced in Palestine. The Haitian police, who have been trained in part by Israel, have participated along with death squads in a series of horrific massacres, including in La Saline, where hundreds were killed. In community after community, homes are being destroyed, families evicted from land by large landowners. All this with the backing of the same Biden administration that is arming and supporting the genocide in Gaza. But like in Palestine, the people of Haiti are resisting. Haiti is the world's first black republic. The people who liberated themselves from a brutal slave system, the people that overthrew the Duvalier dictatorship, the people that have persevered through two bloody coups against the democratically elected Aristide governments have never stopped fighting for their freedom. There is a slogan in Haiti, a slogan that emerged from the Lavalas movement, the people's movement in Haiti, that captures the spirit of resistance in both Haiti and Palestine. Nous peuple obéi. We do not obey. We do not obey the colonialists. We do not obey the fascists. We do not obey the rich who want to keep the oppressed in their place. As we look to the heroic people of Palestine, we say, Haiti, Palestine, one struggle, one fight. Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Those were speakers at a mass rally outside the federal building in San Francisco in solidarity with the Palestinian people. On October 16, the Russian Federation introduced a resolution to the UN Security Council calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. It was voted down, with only Russia, China, Mozambique, Gabon, and the United Arab Emirates voting in favor. The US, UK, France, and Japan voted against it, and the other six members of the Council abstained. 9 of the 15 members must vote yes to pass a resolution, with no vetoes from any of the 5 permanent members, China, Russia, France, the UK, and the US. US Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield objected that the resolution failed to condemn Hamas.
Russia's resolution, put forward without any consultations, make no mention of Hamas. None. By failing to condemn Hamas, Russia is giving cover to a terrorist group that brutalizes innocent civilians. It is outrageous, it is hypocritical, and it is indefensible.
2 days later, on October 18, in the aftermath of a shocking airstrike on the northern Gazan Al-Ali Hospital, the Council failed to adopt another resolution, this time put forth by Brazil, which would have called for humanitarian pauses in the fighting to allow full, safe, and unhindered access for United Nations agencies and their partners to deliver desperately needed aid to Gaza. 12 of the 15 members voted in favor, with Russia and the UK abstaining for different reasons, but the US exercised its veto, even though the resolution condemned Hamas, as U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield had demanded. This time, she said that U.S. diplomatic efforts should supersede the Council's efforts and that the resolution failed to mention Israel's right to defend itself. Like Biden's speech in Israel and then in the Oval Office, Greenfield's remarks were widely perceived to give a green light to Israel. The representatives of the Permanent Observer State of Palestine and the State of Israel were invited to speak after the vote on the second resolution. Here is an excerpt of the remarks of Palestinian Ambassador Riyad H. Mansour.
The whole world is watching. They're watching us. The events of the last 10 days may shape the next 10 years in our region and beyond. What happens next is decisive. If anyone thinks this is a situation under control for which you can plan and implement, they are making false and irresponsible assumptions. This is the kind of war where you know how it starts and have no clue how it ends. Until now, it can be stopped. And it should be stopped immediately. Any further delay is a risk no one should take. Council's failure to shoulder its responsibilities after 10 days of Israeli massacres against the Palestinian people and after the killing of hundreds of people gathered in a hospital to find shelter and care will mark public opinions in our region and the world for a very long time and affect belief in the protections of the law for all people, as well as their perceptions and reactions. Finally, Israel does not deny that it killed entire families, infants, children, their parents, uncles and aunts and cousins, their grandparents, with sometimes up to 45 members of the same family being slaughtered. It has done so repeatedly through the years and is doing it again, this time in the Gaza Strip. It has now killed 3,500 Palestinians, almost all civilians, including more than 1,000 children. It admitted it was killing all of them, but urged it could not do otherwise. Their deaths were not its fault, even though it killed them. But the hospital massacre had such an impact on global public opinion that it had to change tactics and change its original story into a new one. So Israel will deny responsibility for the massacre in the Baptist Hospital Al-Ahli, just as it made every effort to deny its responsibility in the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh and Muhammad al-Durra, and in the many massacres it had perpetrated over the decades, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary.
That was an excerpt of remarks by Palestinian Ambassador to the UN Riyad H. Mansour. Here is an excerpt of remarks by Israeli Ambassador Gilad Menashe Erdan.
Thousands of barbaric Hamas Nazis invaded Israel and brutally murdered 1,400 innocent Israelis as they slept, celebrated, hugged their families in fear, and cried for mercy. This was planned and carried out deliberately by the terrorists that rule Gaza. Today, as we speak, not by accident, not by mistake, but deliberately. There is only one solution to curing a cancer, and it is the evisceration of every cancerous cell, just as was done with ISIS and Al-Qaeda, complete obliteration. This is the only way to ensure such atrocities will never be repeated.
The Israeli ambassador said that Hamas was responsible for the attack on the Al-Ahli hospital, and that the council's sole focus should be Hamas and its crimes.
This council should be purely focused on condemning the Hamas terrorists, supporting Israel's right to defend itself, and demanding from Hamas to immediately and unconditionally return our hostages. Israel's rescue mission can end very quickly if Hamas terrorists turn themselves in and release all of the hostages. But this rescue mission will not end until Israel ensures that Hamas atrocities can never be repeated again. And there is no way to ensure this other than the obliteration of Hamas's capabilities.
After the remarks of the Palestinian and Israeli ambassadors, other ambassadors who had asked to speak were given the floor. They included those of Algeria, Egypt, Jordan, Libya, Oman, Pakistan, South Africa, Syria, Tunisia, and the European Union, with Jordan speaking on behalf of the UN's Arab group. The Arab and Muslim nations and South Africa condemned the attack on the Al-Ahli Hospital, holding Israel responsible. With some variations, they said that the conflict began not on October 7, but with Israel's decades-long occupation of Palestine. They demanded the lifting of the siege and the end of war crimes, including the forced transfer of Palestinians from north to south Gaza, and the end of genocide against the Palestinian people. They also demanded an independent, contiguous Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders with its capital in East Jerusalem. As of the production of this show, 5,000 were reported killed in Gaza. Parents are reported to be writing the names of their children on their legs in case they are separated or killed. Egyptian comedian and TV personality Bassem Youssef used dark humor to shed light on the ongoing Israeli war and occupation of Palestine in a recent interview with British TV host Piers Morgan. Here's an excerpt.
I want to understand, what is the logic of Israel carpet bombing Gaza? I mean, if there is a logic, if it is a good, if this will make Israel safe, I want to hear the logic. So if they continue bombing, what are they hoping to achieve?
Well, we know what their stated aim is. Their stated aim is to eradicate and wipe out Hamas. They believe Hamas are living predominantly in northern Gaza. They also are aware they're living amongst civilians.
So if I can understand this correctly, basically Israel is doing this to pressure the Palestinian community in Gaza to turn against Hamas. Is that right?
I'm sure that's part of it, yes.
That's part of it. So this is exactly what terrorist organizations do, because terrorist organizations will have no chance beating a whole nation in battle. So they terrorize and they kill the civilians in order to spread fear and terror so they can turn against their government to change their policy or to resign. You have just compared Israel with ISIS. Israel Defense Minister, he said, those are human animals. Mm. And the thing is, Ben Shapiro should know better, because, you know, long before the Holocaust, before Jewish people were thrown in the gas chambers, the Nazi propaganda called them rats. Mm. Now, as a human being, I will never accept that another human being being thrown into a gas chamber. But a rat, kill a 10, kill a 1,000, 3,500. They are son of a they are human animals who live in open sewage and decapitate babies. And because of that propaganda, Mr. Morgan, that guy in Illinois, the 71 years old guy, he killed, stabbing the 6 years old Palestinian kid in Illinois 26 times. And he used to play with him. They used to be friends. But he went in, marching into their apartment, stabbing his mother and killing him, shouting, all Muslims could die. Yeah. It took you 8 years to change one word from Jewish to Muslim. Mm. And then you transferred your guilt to us. The thing is, this is the problem. Israel always victimizes itself. And I have never seen a victim putting their oppressor under siege and bombing them 24/7. Israel wants you to believe that they are the victim. Dealing with Israel is so difficult. It's like being in a relationship with a narcissistic psychopath. He f***s you up, and then he makes you think it's your fault.
All right,
you
Bassem,
look at Israel as Superman, but they're really Homelander.
Bassem,
wallahi, they are like, they are shooting
Bassem,
fish in a barrel,
thing.
And they are annoyed with the splashes.
And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.